Okay, good afternoon. Bio 241, March 18th, Wednesday. We're going to finish census chapter today and maybe move on to the endocrine system. So the next test is going to cover autonomic nervous system, senses, and I hope all of endocrinology. We'll see how much of endocrinology we can do, but hopefully we can get all that done and then take a test before spring break. All right, and then I can load you up with a lot of good homework assignments for spring break to make the rest of the class really easy. Okay. Or maybe a take-home test. That's interesting. Okay. That's right. All right, so we were talking about special senses versus general senses. So what's the big difference between a special sense and a general sense? General is all over the body. Give me an example of a general sense that you have all over the body. Yeah, temperature is one. Vibration, touch. Okay, what about one that is sounds like a special sense but is not? Starts with a P. Proprioception. That sounds like a special sense. But it's a general sense because you have proprioceptors all over your body. And every skeletal muscle that you have, joint capsules, tendons, have proprioceptors so that you know what position your body is in. All right? As opposed to special senses. Give me some special senses. Hearing, smell, taste, vision, and equilibrium, the two kinds of equilibrium. And those are special senses. Why? Only very few parts of the body have the receptor cells responsible for transducing that particular kind of energy into what? Signal transduction is going to take maybe thermal energy and convert it into, yeah, you're exactly right, into the language that your brain speaks and understands, and that is action potentials, right? Just different blips. And then you have the perception of these various senses. Why? What can you tell me about an action potential? One action potential next to another one, or before one, or after one, they are what? They're all exactly the same. Oh. So if action potentials are all exactly the same, how is it that you can appreciate different stimuli or changes of intensity? But let's first focus on different senses. Why is it if all action potentials are the same, why is it that when somebody puts an ice cube on you, it feels cold? And why is it when somebody shines a flashlight on you, it looks bright? All right? Why is it when somebody shines a flashlight on you, it doesn't feel cold? Why does it look bright?
Different parts of the brain.
Yes, because those action potentials go to different parts of your cerebral cortex, and that gives you the different sensation, the perception of that different sensation. So it's by the area on the cerebral cortex. That's right. Okay, and then what would you use to explain why differences of intensity of a particular stimulus can be appreciated if an action potential is always the same? Yeah, it's the frequency of action potentials reaching that particular location of your brain is going to then change your perception of its intensity. So we call that frequency coding, don't forget. All right, so I don't know if I turned my cursor on. Let me turn my cursor on. All right, so here we have the ear, and I think we're done talking about static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. I want to just go over that briefly at the end when we're done talking about hearing. And so just to review, what is this bony thing right here called? This whole structure that includes the cochlea, it includes the vestibule, and it includes the semicircular canals, that's called the? And it is the inner ear, it is inside the inner ear, but it's called the vestibular apparatus, yeah, the whole thing. So the, vestibular apparatus is made up of the snail-like structure, the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. And what sense is contained or is the receptors for static equilibrium, where are they located? That's in the vestibule and The utricle and saccule are in the vestibule. We call those maculae. Both the utricle and saccule are maculae. And stop me if I haven't talked about that already, but I think I have. And what about for kinetic equilibrium? Where is that? Where's that at? The semicircular canals, right? And there are organs within the ampullae, right here within the semicircular canals. Those are the crista ampullaris, gives you the sense of rotational acceleration. And then we're talking about hearing. All right, so equilibrium is completely contained within the semicircular canals and the vestibule, but what about, what parts of the ear do you need in order to hear something? What parts of the ear? Well, I'll tell you what are the three main parts of the ear? You got the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. What parts do you need for hearing? As a matter of fact, you need all of them. That's right. Unlike equilibrium, you only need the inner ear in order to appreciate those senses. But, for instance, if we plug up your external auditory meatus with a big wad of cotton, guess what's going to happen to your hearing? It's going to be attenuated. You won't hear quite so well, right? So you definitely need your outer ear. And if you have otitis media, where the middle ear has an infection and it's filled up with fluid, how is your sense of hearing going to be? It's going to sound all plugged up as well, right? You won't hear nearly so well. So you need the middle ear, and of course you need the cochlea. If there's damage to the cochlea, you'll have a hearing deficit as well. So you need all three parts of the ear in order to hear. Not so for your equilibrium senses. All right, so we said that sound pressure is a mechanical wave, right? It's just it's a wave that travels through space, and pressure alternates from high pressure to low pressure and then back up to high pressure again around atmospheric pressure, above and below atmospheric pressure, and it vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth. And the tympanic membrane is connected to fluid inside the cochlea via the auditory ossicles, right? So the auditory ossicles then push on the oval window right here, which then injects that pressure wave into the endolymph of the cochlea. So the difference in relative size of the tympanic membrane compared to the oval window right here, plus the arrangement of the auditory ossicles, acts as an amplifier to make sure that sound waves can actually enter the cochlea. It's a nice kind of amplification system. Because maybe you remember if you were ever swimming sometime and somebody's trying to talk to you, like maybe your mom is saying, okay, get out of the pool now, right? When you're a kid, that was the last thing in the world you really wanted to do. All you had to do is put your head underwater, and what would happen? You couldn't hear your mom anymore, because sound doesn't go into water very easily. It just bounces right off. So you need this middle ear to make sure that pressure waves that are in the air end up in the fluid of your inner ear. Okay. All right, so where were we? I think we're talking maybe about here. So let's unroll the cochlea. All right, and why is it all rolled up? Why is the cochlea all rolled up? Yeah, so it doesn't stick outside your head, right? Because if it was all long, it would be poking outside your head. So evolution has figured out a way to fold it up or roll it up so it fits in a smaller space. So let's unroll it so that we can see what's going on here. Well, all right, so here's the tympanic membrane, here's the oval window, and here is the endolymph that's inside the cochlea. And we see three basic chambers inside the cochlea, so this is a review from anatomy. The one that's connected to the oval window is called the scala vestibuli. This is where sound pressure is injected into the cochlea, and it might go all the way to the end of the cochlea and then find its way out. The end of the cochlea is called the helicotrema, and that pressure has to be released from the cochlea, and the way that it's released is that it can bounce up against the round window right here, and that releases pressure from the cochlea, the sound pressure. And if that round window wasn't there, then that would damage the cochlea and maybe even fracture. There might be enough energy to even break something in there. All right, so that pressure has to be released, the sound pressure. All right, but that's not the only way that sound can move through the cochlea. It can actually take a shortcut across the inner compartment, and that inner compartment is called the cochlear duct. And there's fluid in the cochlear duct. That fluid is what we call endolymph. Okay, and the cochlear duct has a different width. So right now we're looking at the cochlea from the side. We can't really see how wide it is because the width is going into the dimension of the board. So if we go to the top of the cochlea and look down on it, we can see that the width is not constant. Right? It looks like it's constant over here, but let's look from top down. If we look from top down, this is what the cochlea looks like. All right, so let's just say that right here is the oval window. So here's oval window, and there's the other end of the cochlea. What do we call the other end of the cochlea? That's the helicotrema, right? Helicotrema right here. And so you can see that the shape changes. And when the shape of something changes, what can you tell me? Yeah, function changes, right? And as a matter of fact, when I look at this, and when I think of sound, I think of a musical instrument. Like what kind of musical instrument has this sort of arrangement to it? Yeah, like a piano or a harp or something, right? So if you have a piano, right, we have some strings that are very, very short, and then some strings that are like mid-size, and some strings that are really, really long. And they all have their characteristic frequency at which they like to resonate at based on the length of the strings. And so the cochlea will do the same thing. It will resonate at different frequencies depending on the width of the cochlea. So for instance, high frequency sounds will have a tendency to vibrate this part of the cochlea because it's very, very short. Low frequency sounds will vibrate the cochlea near the helicotrema. All right. So sound doesn't have to go all the way to the helicotrema. It can actually make a shortcut. And what this diagram shows that high frequencies cut across through the cochlear duct where very proximal to the oval window, very low frequencies will cut across the cochlear duct right near the helicotrema, and then somewhere in the middle are the mid-range frequencies. And when those sounds take a shortcut, guess what they do? They vibrate, right, this tissue that's in the cochlear duct. And we're going to take a look and see what that tissue looks like next. Okay, so if you think of your inner ear, maybe you should really think of it as a piano. So you actually have two pianos, one in one side of your ear and one in the other side of your head. Okay, and it just resonates depending on the frequencies that enter it. All right, so here is a cross-section of the cochlea. All right, so here's the scale of vestibuli. This is connected to, what, the oval window. So sound enters this this fluid right here. And let's just say that this is the particular region where that sound wants to cross. So if it's high frequency, it's going to be near the oval window. It cuts across. It goes through the cochlear duct, ends up in the scala tympani right here. And when it moves across, it's going to produce vibrations in this structure. And the roof of this structure is the pectoral membrane. This is the one that's actually going to flop up and down as sound vibrations move across. And can you picture that sound produces vibrations? What's a good example of that you could actually show me or yourself that sound actually produces vibrations? Yeah, a guitar string, right? Or if you look at inside a piano, if a string is making a tone, it's going to be vibrating back and forth. Or something else that you could do is you could just hop in your car and turn the radio on full blast and look at your rear view mirrors, and what are they doing? They're bouncing to the music because music, that sound is just a pressure wave, right? So as sound moves across this tectorial membrane, it's going to bounce up and down just like your rear view mirrors are going to bounce up and down if you have the music loud enough. You're looking at me strange. Am I the only person that does that? No, I don't think so. Okay. So the tectorial membrane is going to move up and down. So don't forget, sound is just a mechanical wave. And when the tectorial membrane bounces up and down, that introduces vibrations into this whole structure right here. And this is what we call the organ of Corti. So this is the organ, the soft tissue, that actually gives us the perception of sound. This transduces sound energy into action potentials. All right, so let's zoom into this region right here. And here we have our old favorite kinds of cells that we had, receptor cells in the ear. What was the kind of receptor cell that was used for static equilibrium? The receptor cell? A hair cell. That sounds strange, but you're right. What about for kinetic equilibrium? What was the receptor cell for kinetic equilibrium? It was a hair cell, right. All right, well, what do we got right here? For hearing, they are hair cells once again, right? So hair cells are used for all three senses in the inner ear, but these hair cells, instead of connected to otoliths or to a gelatinous mass, the stereocilia are connected to the tectorial membrane. When the tectorial membrane vibrates, that vibrates the stereocilia, which then opens or closes sodium channels, which then can inhibit or excite these cells. They make generator potentials, which then cause action potentials on the vestibulocochlear nerve, and then that takes sound information to your brain. Right? Now, these nerves are connected to what? One particular location in the organ of Corti. And so they're going to carry just basically what? One tone to your brain. And that tone, those nerves are going to connect up to an area in your brain that's responsible for that tone. That's why you hear that particular tone. So actually on the surface of your brain, oh, what lobe is the auditory cortex in? That's the temporal lobe. There are actually like pianos. You could think that there are pianos in your temporal lobes. And if you stimulate one area, you hear a high frequency. If you stimulate the other end of your auditory cortex, you're going to hear a low frequency. And if you stimulate somewhere in the middle, you're going to hear a mid-range frequency. And when I say frequency, what does that mean to you? That means the tone, right? The tone or the pitch. That's a good word. The pitch of that particular frequency. All right? And so if there are three particular tones or pitches that are entering your ear, maybe a high one and a middle one and a low one, there'll be three different areas on your auditory cortex that will receive those action potentials, and then that will sound like a chord if the arrangement of those pitches is just right. Right? Or it might be some kind of dissonant chord, because a chord is usually made up of three tones when you put them together. All right, so you got these hair cells once again, okay, that will form, that will generate generator potentials depending on, right, the movement of this tectorial membrane. And the more this tectorial membrane moves, the greater in amplitude that generator potential will be, which then translates into what, a higher frequency of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so this is how it gets into the brain. So from the organ of Corti, so that's how I'm going to talk about it in this class. I don't really talk about it much in terms of the spiral organ in anatomy. I usually talk about it as the organ of Corti. Comes in the vestibular cochlear nerve to the medulla oblongata, and we see that there are some synapses here. So these are what? These are nuclei. We don't have to know the names of these nuclei, but what is a nucleus in the central nervous system? Again, it's just a group of cell bodies, right? So you can see that these cell bodies, right? There's thousands and thousands of these cell bodies, and a second order neuron is going to take information up to the brain stem, or actually the midbrain. And remember, there's a couple little bumps on the posterior part of the midbrain. We call those the inferior colliculi. Anybody remember what the inferior colliculi are for? It's part of the corpora quadrigemina. Who remembers their anatomy? Yeah? Okay, the corpora quadrigemina might ring a bell, but this is where you can localize sound. You can tell where sound is coming from. Right, so if you close your eyes and somebody opens a door, you can tell if it's this door that's opening, or that door, or that one, because sound doesn't arrive at both ears at the same time. So this door is going to arrive to my right ear before my left, and that's the part of the brain that can look at the temporal signature of that sound and then give information to your brain. Then it's got to share it with your cortex right here where that sound is coming from. So we call that localization. The inferior colliculi right here. All right, that sound also is shared because before sensory information reaches the cortex, cerebral cortex, it has to pass through what's this area right here? That's the thalamus, right? So the thalamus, you always learned, was a relay center or station for sensory signals going to the cerebral cortex. All right, so where is the thalamus going to direct this signal to? The temporal lobe. And here we see the temporal lobe. So this is the primary auditory cortex right here. So just think maybe there is something like a piano right here. So if we stimulate these neurons right here, you're going to have the perception of a high frequency. If we stimulate this area way over here, you're going to have the perception of a low frequency, and then somewhere in between will be some like middle range type of frequency. So again, you have like two pianos on either side of your head right here. But these are on the cerebral cortex, not inside the organ of Corti. Now, let's take this neuron that's going through the temporal lobe that is carrying auditory information from the organ of Corti, and let's string it somewhere else. Let's unstring it from the temporal lobe and then route it to the occipital lobe. So when you hear something, when action potentials come in from the organ of Corti, they get to the thalamus and now go to the occipital lobe instead of the temporal lobe, what's going to be your perception? You're going to have some kind of visual experience based on what? Sound pressure. And that doesn't happen. I don't think I've ever known a case for that. And you can't elect to have that. There's no surgery to do that. I'm just saying that so that illustrates the point that your perception is based on what? Certain regions of the cerebral cortex. And action potentials have to get to that region. All right, so even if signals get to the midbrain right here, you still have no conscious idea of what's happening there, right? This information still has to be shared with the auditory cortex in order for you to know, because you correlate it then with visual information, right? So this still, depolarization or action potentials in the midbrain still don't rise to the level of consciousness. It's still more like a reflex. Okay, so that's a pathway for auditory signals going into the brain. So let's wrap that up real quick. What are the three senses that are contained in the ear?
Hearing.
All right, we got hearing. Yeah, static. And I'm just going to abbreviate it EQ, and then kinetic. EQ. What parts of the ear are necessary for hearing? You know what? Let's do that outer, middle, inner. Outer? You agree with outer? Middle? Inner. What about static equilibrium? Inner. Only inner. What about kinetic equilibrium? Inner only. That's right. All right, now considering the inner ear, what's the bony labyrinth for hearing? All right, the bony labyrinth for hearing is the cochlea. This is true. What about for static equilibrium?
Vestibule.
Yeah, well, see, you guys know some anatomy, or it's coming back. All right, what about for angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium? The semicircular canals. Semicircular canals. All right, now what about the receptor organ for these different senses? Did I do this already? I hope I didn't, because, yeah.
You did part of it.
I only did part of it. Okay, let's fill in the rest. All right, what about the receptor organ? What about for hearing?
Organ of Corti.
Yeah. Organ of Corti. Now it gets a little bit tougher. What about for static equilibrium?
Maculae.
Yeah, the maculae. And for kinetic equilibrium. Yeah, the crista ampullaris. And so you should probably have a picture in your mind of what these organs look like. What's a distinguishing feature of the organ of Corti that these other organs don't have? Ampullaris. Okay, I caught up. Crista ampullaris. What does the organ of Corti have that the maculae and crista ampullaris don't have? How about tectorial membrane? That's a good one. Okay, organ of Corti has that tectorial membrane, that little flap that moves up and down that excites those stereocilia. What about the maculae? What do they have? That's really interesting. It has? Yeah, but what about organ of Corti? Does organ of Corti have hair cells? Yes, so I want a distinguishing feature, a feature that the other organs don't have. What does a maculae have that none of these other have?
Otoliths.
Yeah, those crystals. You have crystals. Okay. And what about the crista ampullaris? What does it have that the other ones don't have? It's got the Cupula, that gelatinous mass that kind of looks like a hat that's sitting right on top of the hair cells, right, the cupula, just to kind of maybe conjure some images in your mind. Right, so that's the organs, and what about the actual receptor cells? What about the receptor cells? Okay, they're all hair cells, right? They're all hair cells that have those stereocilia that when they bend, that will then start generator potentials, which then can trigger action potentials if the generator potential reaches threshold. Yeah. Has a tectorial membrane. Tectorial membrane. All right, so probably, I can't remember which ones of those are exam figures. Maybe all of those are. Organ accordi, maybe the crustampulari. That's not so difficult to remember. You just have to look at those a couple times. All right, so sound is the result of a pressure wave, a variation of high pressure, then going below atmospheric pressure, coming back. So it's a wave, but it's a mechanical wave. Vision is the result of being able to perceive waves, but it's not a mechanical wave. It's an electromagnetic wave. So it's a different kind of thing. It's not mechanical at all. It's a variation in an electrical field and a magnetic field through space. And that's all we're going to talk about that because it's not a physics class necessarily. So if it's not a mechanical wave, you can't have a mechanical receptor. You can't have a hair cell, for instance, because it's not going to produce a vibration. You actually have to have something that can pick up an electromagnetic wave. What have you used in your life to pick up an electromagnetic wave? Say that again? A magnet? I've never used one of those, but that's interesting. Okay. What device that you have in your pocket uses electromagnetic waves?
Cell phone.
A cell phone. What does a cell phone have? These fancy ones don't have one, but they're really, really small. You need an antenna. Right, you need an antenna to pick up an electromagnetic wave, and where you have antennas is in the retina of your eye, and I'm going to show you what that antenna looks like. It's called rhodopsin. Okay, but so let me go back to talking about waves just a little bit more. So electromagnetic waves, this is the whole electromagnetic wave spectrum. Some are very low frequencies, like radio waves. Microwaves are a little bit shorter in frequency, but not much shorter. Infrared is even shorter still. Ultraviolet is fairly high frequency, shorter wavelength. And then we get into some other electromagnetic waves, like X-rays and gamma rays. These are very short wavelength kinds of electromagnetic radiation. These are what? Very high frequencies. And as you go from low frequency to high frequency, the energy of that particular wave changes as well. So you could probably tell me how much energy is in an X-ray compared to, say, a radio wave. Okay? Okay, so which one is low, X-ray or radio wave?
The X-ray is low.
Okay. I need to change your opinion on that one.
X-ray is high.
X-ray is high. As the frequency increases, the energy goes way up, and as a matter of fact, right, we're surrounded with radio waves all the time, day in and day out, because radio stations and TV stations are doing what? They're broadcasting radio waves, so they just go right through your body. Right? X-rays can go right through your body, but how many X-rays can you get in a day? Could you get an X-ray all day long?
Yeah.
No, that would cause cancer, that would kill you, because they're high energy. So X-rays are very high energy, right? So you can't subject yourself to very many X-rays, or shouldn't. And visible light is somewhere in the middle, but you can see it's what, a very narrow range compared to all electromagnetic radiation. And if we were to expand it, you get this thing here. This is the visible light spectrum, which is basically what?
Rainbow?
It's just basically a rainbow, right. And sun emits all of these wavelengths right here, or all of these frequencies, and what our eyes can perceive is what? Just this narrow range right here that we use for vision. And that's kind of handy because the different energies of light actually look like different colors. And did you ever learn that little mnemonic that you can say to know what colors are next to each other in the rainbow? So for instance, I know that this is red. okay, by knowing the mnemonic. Okay, and then this here is orange. Okay, and this is yellow. Okay, and then this is green in the middle. So you can say this guy's name, Roy G. Biv, okay, tells you what colors are next to each other in the rainbow, and those just correspond to different energy levels, right? Different energy levels. And things can absorb certain kinds of colors, and chemicals that can absorb energy at a particular wavelength or color are called something. What are they called? Maybe from anatomy you can remember, because your body produces some of these things that we talked about, especially in terms of the integument, when you studied the integument. What are chemicals in your integument that can absorb light called? They're called, a melanocyte is the cell that produces melanin, which absorbs the harmful ultraviolet, more the ultraviolet, as well as some of the visible light, so that protects your skin cells. And so what do we call melanin? Generally, any kind of chemical that can absorb light is called a pigment. Okay, so pigment absorbs light. So pigments are actually acting as antennas for these different wavelengths of light. All right, and so melanin is a brown to black pigment, and it absorbs almost all visible light. Since the sun emits all of these colors right here, the absence of color will be what? Very, very dark. And white, if we combine all of these colors together at one time, then it will be white. It will look white to us. Okay. So what color do plants normally look like?
Green.
Green. Yes, very good. Okay. Some maybe have fancy colors, but generally they're green. So what can you tell me about the pigment in plants? What does it do? What is it actually doing? It's absorbing red, yeah, it's absorbing red, orange, yellow, okay, and then it's reflecting green, and then it starts to absorb that blue, indigo, and violet again over on this area. And so don't forget, light really is energy, because this is low energy here, here's a little bit higher energy. Plants can absorb that because they have a pigment called chlorophyll, and the kind of color that chlorophyll does not absorb is green, so it's reflected off the plant, and so the green light enters your eye, and a plant looks, therefore, green to you as a result of that. So a pigment is really the antenna that is absorbing different energies of light. Okay, and we have some pigments in our eye that absorb light, and don't forget, light is energy, so the retina is specialized to transduce light energy into what? Into what's the language of your brain?
Chemical energy.
Yeah, it's chemical energy, but what I'm really thinking about is action potentials, right? So that's the job of the retina, to absorb light. There are pigments that act as antennas that pick up these different energies that convert that signal into action potentials that your brain can understand. And what lobe of the brain should those signals go to? The occipital lobe for sure, right? Okay. All right, so there are some structures that are directly responsible for absorbing light and transducing it. That's the retina. And then there are other structures in the eye that we call accessory structures that help the function of the eye but don't necessarily absorb light. All right, the iris is one of those accessory structures. The iris controls the size of the pupil. And so the pupil is what? The pupil is really a hole in the iris. The pupil is not a structure, it's really a hole. You can think of it as a foramen for the passage of light into the eye. The pupil constricts by a contraction of circular smooth muscles when it's very bright outside. That diminishes the amount of light that can enter the eye, that protects your retina. Right, that's under parasympathetic control, but your pupil can also dilate. It can get bigger, it can dilate when radial muscles are stimulated to contract, and that enlarges the pupil, that allows more light to enter the cell. Wait a second, I went way far too many slides. Okay, so here is the iris. Here is the pupil, which is a hole in the iris. And you can see two different arrangements. You could consider these almost as like fascicles of smooth muscle. You can see the circular smooth muscle right here and the radial fibers. And they're connected to each other. So when these radial fibers contract right here, that pulls on the circular muscles, and it causes what? Dilation of the iris, and that's under sympathetic control. So sympathetic will stimulate these radial fibers to contract, that enlarges your pupil. All right, but if it's really bright light, right, the sympathetic stimulation is decreased, and parasympathetic stimulation is increased. The parasympathetic goes to the circular smooth muscles, and when these circular smooth muscles contract, what happens to the size of a circular muscle when it contracts? Does it get bigger or does it get smaller? It gets smaller, right? So, for instance, when the orbicularis oculi contract, what happens to your eyes? Okay, they close, right? And when it relaxes, your eyes open up. Same thing for your mouth. What's the circular muscle around your mouth called? It's an orbicularis oris, right? It's skeletal muscle, but nonetheless, when it contracts, your mouth closes, and when it relaxes, your mouth opens. So when you're chewing, the orbicularis oris contracts, so that what? So that food doesn't pop out of your mouth when you chew, right? Okay. Well, my poor mom I'm using her as an example. She always told me, close your mouth. And she should have said, depolarize what? Your orbicularis oris. All right, so these circular muscles right here, when they're stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system, they what? That causes pupil constriction, just based on light right here. All right, so you should probably be aware of the dual innervation or the complementary nature of the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system in terms of vision. All right, there's another accessory structure that's very important for vision, and that is the ciliary muscle right here and the lens. All right, but let's go back. Before I talk about the ciliary muscle, let's go back to this other model we had. When does these circular muscles of the iris cause pupil constriction? When they relax or when they contract? When they contract, that causes constriction. All right, so I want you to remember that when we talk about this ciliary muscle right here. All right, so here is the lens, and the job of the lens is to make sure that all light rays that are entering your eye converge and focus on the retina. Now, way back when I started taking photographs of people, you actually had to focus a camera. Nowadays, you just point and push a little button and it automatically turns into a nice focused image. But can you imagine taking a picture and not have the lens in focus? What did the picture look like? It looks blurry, like fuzzy, right? Okay. So the job of these lenses right here is to focus light on the retina so it doesn't look blurry. And in order to do that, the lens has to change shape. So the lens changes shape. So can you see the lens right here? This is a really zoomed in region of an eye. And the muscle that changes the shape of the lens is this ciliary muscle. Now, why is that important? Because you can't focus on everything in the world at one time. So what you should maybe do is extend your hand out in front of you and stick your pointing finger up in the air and then focus on your nail, on your finger. All right, so focus on that, and without changing your focus, concentrate on the background. What does the background look like? Yeah, all of a sudden I have like 500 students in here. Okay, because everything in the background, I see multiple images, it's out of focus, and the only thing that's in focus is my nail. Now, keep your fingers still there. Now, don't focus on your finger, but focus on somebody way in front, like in the front of the room, back of the room for me. What does your finger look like? It's a blur. Maybe I see like two of them plus a blur. Okay? So you can really only focus your attention at one distance from your eye at a time, and you get to choose what that distance is. All right? The ability to change your depth of focus or distance of focus is what we call accommodation. So eyes can't have everything in focus, only one distance from your eye. And what changes right here is the lens. The lens gives you the ability to do that. So how does the shape of the lens change? Well, it's activated or changed by the tension that's produced by the ciliary muscle. All right, so I think maybe the next slide shows me that right here. So here we have a case where an object is far away. Where does it say it on the slide? In this particular case, the top one, A, the distance should be far away from the object. That means that light that's entering the eye is very parallel. If light is coming from far away, All the light that is spreading apart is already spread apart and you don't see it. So light is very parallel. So the lens does not have to be very curved in order to focus light on the retina. But objects that are close, light is still very divergent. It is still moving away from each other. So you need a lot of curvature of the lens in order to bend the light back so that it focuses on the retina. So the lens has to be more curved. And when that happens, it's very, very thick. When the lens is thick, there's more curvature. When the lens is flat, it's very, very thin. Okay, so how does the ciliary muscle apply or not apply tension to the lens? Well, there are some ligaments. Here are the suspensory ligaments. You can see suspensory ligaments that kind of look like spokes on a wheel. Right, and here is the ciliary muscle. Usually, when a muscle contracts, what happens to tension on a ligament? Like, for instance, when my rectus femoris right here contracts, what happens to tension on my patellar ligament? It increases, right? And that's going to make my leg move one way or the other. Well, this system is pretty ingenious. It works the other way around. So you have to ponder this just a little bit. Okay? When the circular muscle, the ciliary muscle, relaxes, what happens to it? Does it shrink? Does it get smaller? Or does it get bigger? When it relaxes, it gets bigger because of elasticity of muscle. And as it gets bigger, what happens to the tension on these suspensory ligaments? Well, you see the tension actually increases when the muscle relaxes. So let's really relax the ciliary muscle so it's as big as this room, but the length of these ligaments right here doesn't change. What is that going to produce? A lot of tension, right? The bigger that ciliary body gets, the more tension that's applied to the suspensory ligaments. The more tension that's applied, then the more the lens is stretched out, and then the flatter it gets. Now, the opposite thing happens when the ciliary muscle contracts. When it contracts, what happens to it? It gets smaller. What happens to the tension on these suspensory ligaments then? As the muscle gets smaller, the tension goes away, right? Because the length of these tendons don't increase. And then what happens to the lens right here? When the tension in the suspensory ligaments, then it can pucker up. Right, it can get smaller and it can get thicker and have more curvature so that you can focus on something very close. All right, so changing your length of focus from your eye is what we call what? Accommodation. That's accommodation. And what does that do to? That's due to the lens right here, changing the shape of the lens. Unfortunately, as we get older, the shape of the lens changes, but it also gets stiffer, like a lot of things in our body get stiffer. It doesn't like to change as much, right? So we have trouble accommodating, and the other thing is that it takes longer to accommodate, too, as we get older. The lens just takes more time to change shape. So that kind of explains why, say, when you're in your 70s or 80s, when you're driving down the freeway, how do you drive? Even though maybe you can see really well, maybe you got good glasses, but you're still driving really slow. Why? Because of accommodation right here. So if you're in your 80s, what's one thing you don't ever want to get? You don't want to get a motorcycle. Okay, I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway. You don't want to get a speeding ticket, right? Because if you're in that age group and you get a speeding ticket, what happens to your driver's license? Well, it gets yanked, right? And you don't ever drive again. All right, so when you're in that age group, you just don't speed. So how is it that you don't speed? You look at the speedometer, right? You're on the freeway, and you look at the speedometer, and you go, oh, okay, I'm going 25 miles an hour. I'm not speeding. No ticket. Don't have to worry about anything. All right, but there's something else that happens. All right, even though you're not speeding, and you're glad you're not speeding, what are you worried about next that pops into your mind? Where is, like, the last place in the world you want to be when you're driving in that age group? Like on the 405 freeway. So you want to make sure you don't miss your exit, right? So you're looking at the speedometer and then you're worried, well, I don't want to miss my exit. So what do? You look, where's the speedometer? It's close to you. And then you look out the windshield because you want to see your exit, but where's your exit? It's far away. What does your eye have to do? It's got to accommodate. So the lens has to change shape. So you look up from the speedometer and you look at the windshield and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry, right? 1001, 1002. Okay, and then things pop into focus, And then you can breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh, I see my exit. I didn't pass it yet. Okay? But that doesn't last very long because what are you worried about next? Speeding. Okay? So you look from the windshield down to the speedometer and you look at the speedometer. What do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry. 1001, 1002, it pops into focus and then you're relieved again. Say, I'm not getting a speeding ticket. But then what are you worried about? Did I miss my exit? So you look out the window, what do you see? Yeah, nothing, right? So anyway, when you're driving on the freeway and you see somebody driving 25 miles an hour, you should just be really kind to those viejitos out there because they just can't see things very well. Just give them a lot of space, right? Because when you get to be that age, you will want people to be nice to you too, right? All right, so that is accommodation. Requires what? The suspensory ligaments and the ciliary muscle. It's just that this is kind of strange because the tendon in these suspensory ligaments goes up when the muscle relaxes, which is different than how most muscles and tendons are arranged in your body. And when the muscle contracts, that decreases the tension. When the muscle relaxes, that increases the tension and changes that lens to change shape. Okay. So that's the basis of how we like to correct for vision as well. All right, so the lens bends light so that all the light that's coming from an object focuses on one spot on the retina. That's when it will look the sharpest, the clearest. So because of the curvature of the lens, that will bend light properly. All right, but the eyeball has to have the proper length. It has to have the proper distance between the lens and the retina in order to see things clearly. And guess what? That's not always guaranteed by genetics that you're going to have the proper shaped eyeball so that everything focuses very nicely. But if you're lucky enough for that to happen, that's normal vision, right? We call that emmetropia. But for instance, if somebody has an eyeball that's too short, then the light rays will focus behind the retina. And so here's an image on the retina, and it's going to be what? Blurry. It's not going to be at one point. It's going to be a blurry image. So what has to happen there, this condition is called hyperopia or farsightedness. We use a convex lens that starts to spread the light out, right, so that by the time it reaches the retina, it's focused in one spot. That's for farsightedness. And for nearsightedness or myopia, that's pretty easy to remember, because usually we use that in everyday language when somebody doesn't think far enough ahead, just thinks about their immediate environment. We call that myopic vision, right? So that's nearsightedness. That's because somebody's eyeball is way too long and the image focuses way in front of the retina. And so we have to use a concave lens, okay, to spread the light rays out before they reach the eye so that they're in focus on the retina right here. All right, and before we get to astigmatism, I just want to say one last thing. You see, the lens has a lot of curvature to it, but what other structure of the eye has curvature, just like the lens does? Yeah, look at that cornea right there. See this cornea? Look at that nice curvature of the cornea right here. So the cornea acts as a lens as well. The cornea, though, can't change shape because there's no ciliary body around it, but the cornea is actually more important in focusing light on the retina than the lens is. The lens is only there really for accommodation purposes, right? The cornea is really the big focusing element of the eye. And that just tells you something about kind of a popular procedure right now where you can get your vision corrected without glasses, and that's by changing the shape of the cornea. All right, what's that procedure called? That's called a LASIK procedure, where they remove some of the epithelium off of the cornea and then measure the shape of the retina and the shape of the cornea and figure out what the shape of the cornea has to be in order to match up with the retina, and then blast away some cells of the cornea right here without disturbing your vision, if all goes well, right? So that light is focused on the retina, and within, you know, just fractions of a second, you can have perfect vision again. And then they replace that flap of skin, and it's really kind of an amazing procedure, right? And it's really nice because you don't have to dig around with anything that's deep inside the eyeball. It's what? Basically right on the surface. So it's a relatively easy procedure again if what? Everything goes well. Now, computers can make mistakes and physicians can make mistakes and all that kind of thing, And that would be terrible if it happens, and it does happen. And so I don't recommend that kind of procedure for cosmetic reasons, but I would recommend it for good medical reasons. For instance, if your vision is so poor to where you can't even find your glasses in the morning, right, this kind of procedure is going to change your life, right? So it's really wonderful. Or if you're a professional athlete, like a boxer or something, I wouldn't recommend somebody stepping into the ring with glasses on so that you can see what's happening. I would do a LASIK procedure. But there are some complications to a LASIK procedure. Again, a reason why it should only be for elective, non-cosmetic reasons. And that is, as you get older, okay, what happens to your ability to accommodate again? It's difficult. It's slower. Plus, you can't focus close up anymore. Right? So for me right now, I can still read pretty well if I take my glasses off. So my glasses are for far vision. All right, but when I put them on, it destroys my near vision. So if I want to read something, all I have to do is take off my far vision glasses and I can see up close. All right, so we call that a trade-off. All right, and then if I put my far vision glasses on, what happens to my reading? It's all blurry. Okay, well, that's just basic physics of how the lenses are arranged with the cornea and the lens inside my eye. And the same thing happens when you get a LASIK procedure. Right, so when you get a LASIK procedure, it's tuned for far vision. So when you get far vision tuned up, what happens to your near vision? Especially when you're older, it gets degraded. Right? So if you're a really young person, you can accommodate and it doesn't bother you, but maybe if you're in your 30s, maybe late 20s even, okay, when you get a LASIK procedure, it can wipe out your near vision almost immediately. And I've known a lot of people to go get a LASIK procedure and walk out, you know, it's very nice, and they walk out on the street and say, oh God, what an amazing world, I can see everything clearly. And then they get a phone call, and they pull out their cell phone, look at their cell phone, and guess what? Can't see the cell phone. They don't even know how to use a cell phone anymore, just immediately like that. All right, so then they don't need faraway glasses. Now what do they need? They need reading glasses to work the cell phone. Right, so there's that trade-off right there. So if you're ever interested in a LASIK procedure, make sure you go talk to a reputable physician that will explain all these things to you so that you're not so surprised when stuff like that happens, right? Okay, and that might be acceptable to a lot of people, right? But maybe not to everybody. Okay, this last condition over here is astigmatism, where there is an uneven curvature of the lens so that sometimes, you, depending on where the image is, maybe if it's entering your eye at the bottom, okay, things will focus, but light that's entering the top over here won't focus, and so now you need an asymmetrical lens to correct so that all light focuses on the retina at the proper location. And in lab, you did a test for that. You looked at a circle, basically, and looked at the center of the circle. And if the whole circle looked like it was in focus, no astigmatism. But if one part of the circle was out of focus, that means that the lens was not completely spherically symmetrical. And that's what we call astigmatism. And I don't know if things like that can be corrected by LASIK procedure. I think they're starting to be able to do things like that. The other thing about LASIK procedure. Yes, go ahead. Your question. They can't correct yet? Yeah, they can't do that yet? Okay, they might be able to do that maybe with a lens implant, a prosthetic lens one of these days pretty soon. Now that's maybe what I would be more interested in, because if you get a prosthetic lens, if it doesn't work, you can take it out. But once you have a LASIK procedure, right, it can't really be redone. Maybe it can be modified to some degree one way or the other. And that takes me to my last point, and that is, during your lifetime, what happens to the shape of your eyeball? It changes. As a matter of fact, a lot of people, as they get older, they can just throw their glasses away. They still might need reading glasses, but their vision for far away actually gets better because the shape of their eyeball changes. And if you get a LASIK procedure, and then 20 years later your eyeball changes, guess what? How good the LASIK procedure is? Well, it doesn't relate to your current vision. Right, so LASIK is good for that one point in time in your life, not forever and ever and ever. All right, so I'm looking forward to getting older so that my vision will get better. Hopefully. Okay, so what part, so that's the accessory structures. Other accessory structures would be what? Like, for instance, your eyelids. What's another name for an eyelid? How about palpebrae? Does that ring a bell from anatomy? Eyelashes. eyebrows, lacrimal glands. Those are all accessory structures. All right, well, let's talk about the primary structure for vision, and that is the retina. All right, and so maybe in lab you reviewed eye anatomy, and if not, you got to go back and review eye anatomy, like the three layers that make up the eyeball itself, the outer layer, the white part of your eye, that's a sclera, the middle part is a choroid, and then the inner part that has photoreceptors, right, is the retina. So here we see enlarged view of the retina. Oh, here are the layers right here, choroid, sclera, not drawn to scale, however. Okay, so here is the retina, and you can see there are a lot of nervous tissue cells that make up the retina, different layers right here. This right here is the posterior chamber of the eye filled with vitreous humor, and light comes in, and it's got to bypass, got to pass through all these ganglion cells and amacrine cells, and here are some nice bipolar cells, bipolar neurons, okay, even some horizontal cells, until it gets to the photoreceptor cells that are deep, okay, in the retina. So light has to pass through all of these different things before you can see it. And you can see two different kinds of shapes in the retina. There are things that look like rods and things that look like cones. And these are in basically two different locations in the retina, and they have two different functions. Because, of course, they have two different shapes. But the shape of these cells pretty much is going to be determined by the kinds of pigments that they have. All right, let me go to the next slide because it shows you. So we're not going to talk much about the arrangement, the neuroanatomy of these bipolar cells and horizontal cells. So there is a lot of information processing because you see a lot of divergence and convergence of signals that happen in the retina before it even goes to your brain. So there's a lot of signal processing that we don't get into in this class. All right, so we should just think about action potentials, right, being produced by these bipolar cells, which then get transmitted to the optic nerve, which then takes it to the occipital lobe. All right, so these are the cells that make the generator potentials that can trigger an action potential. You got two different kinds, the rods and cones. And on the next slide, draw the figure for me. Ah, here it is. I must have skipped a couple slides. Okay. This is the next slide. Is it the next slide in your notes? No? Okay, I'm going to use the arrows so I don't skip over too many. Okay. So here you see a rod cell, and here you see a cone cell. So on this slide, which one is smaller? This is drawn to scale, relative scale for the rods and cones. Which one is smaller? Yeah, the cone is definitely smaller. All right, so it has a smaller receptive field because it is smaller. That means it is less sensitive to light. So in order for the cone cells to make generator potentials, it has to receive a lot of light because it's just not as sensitive. Because the surface area of a rod cell is a lot greater, it's more sensitive to light. Rod cells work in dim light. Another way of saying that, cone cells work only in bright light as a result. Cone cells are responsible for color vision, and rod cells are responsible only for black and white. So you can see shades of gray and black and white in very dim light conditions, but in order to see color, you need to stimulate cone cells. And what kind of light do you need in order to see color? You need bright light. The other difference is, since the cone cells are smaller, cone cells will give you much more resolution. You can see finer detail. You can see finer objects with cone cells compared to rod cells. So rod cells will only give you coarse vision. But what's the trade-off for that? So a lot of things when you engineer things or design things or things evolve, something is gained at the expense of some loss. Right, so rod cells work in dim light, but what do you lose? You lose color vision. Right, cone cells work, okay, you can see colored light, but in order to see color, the light has to be high intensity in order to see it. Okay, so make sure you know the distinction between these. All right, so these photoreceptor cells, you have an outer segment filled with discs Can you see some discs right here? And cone cells have an outer segment with discs. Then you have the inner segment, which contains the cell body and then cytoplasm with mitochondria for making ATP. And so this is the area, the tips of the photoreceptor cells that are near the choroid. These are the kind that are pointing to the direction that light is coming in. And here you can see the synaptic endings of these receptor cells. Okay. Oh, I didn't use the arrow. Let me use the arrow. Okay. All right, so there's a pigment, and a pigment really is what? An antenna that can pick up electromagnetic radiation of a particular energy, which means what? Which means color. And I'm only going to talk about the rod cells. So we're only going to talk about shades of gray. And the kind of pigment that's in rod cells is called rhodopsin. Rhodopsin has two parts to it. There's an opsin protein and a retinol molecule, and you can see this retinol is just what relatively large organic molecule, and it can change shape. It can change between a cis conformation between these two carbons right here, okay, and a trans configuration, which is this. And so that either puts a bend in the molecule or flattens the molecule out, just depending on the nature of this carbon bond right here. All right, and when it's bent, it can fit into the opsin molecule very easily and form one molecule that we call rhodopsin. But that molecule, rhodopsin, can absorb light. And when it absorbs light, that energy goes into this chemical bond and causes it to twist and rotate. And when it twists and rotates, guess what happens to retinol? It flattens out. And when it flattens out, it doesn't fit in the opsin molecule anymore. All right, so that's a reaction that we call bleaching. That's a bleaching reaction as a result of light causes a change in conformation. So this right here is the antenna that's used by your retina to absorb light. Okay. And when it changes shape like this, it causes a dissociation of retinol from opsin, and then there have to be metabolic changes within the rod and cone cells to reconfigure the retinol molecule to change it back to the cis form so that it can recombine with opsin. And when that happens, then you can see light again, right? So that happens, and that takes some time to happen, for instance. So for instance, if you're in a dark room for a long period of time, you have very little bleaching going on. That's when your eyes are most sensitive to light. But if you're walking inside of a building from outside where it's really bright sunlight, like today, when you start to look around, it probably looks really dim and hard to see things in a building because all of your rhodopsin is bleached, all right, and you won't have vision. Okay. All right, so let's see, what time is it? We still got some time. All right, so this system is a lot different than all the other receptor systems and ways that we've explained how information is passed between neurons. This kind of works as the inverse of most systems that we have already looked at. All right, so visual transduction. What's transduction again? It's taking energy and converting it into action potentials. So it's taking light energy, converting it into action potentials. It is the inverse of other sensory systems. In the dark, the photoreceptors release inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarize the bipolar neurons. Can you remember where those bipolar neurons were? Bipolars are between the optic nerve and the rods and cones. So it kind of act like little relay neurons between the photoreceptors and the optic nerve right here. Okay. Light inhibits the photoreceptors from releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, thus that stimulates the bipolar cells. All right, the rods and cones contain many sodium channels, and these sodium channels are open in the dark. So in the dark, do you consider that when the stimulus is being applied to your eye, or is that lack of stimulus in the dark? That's lack of stimulus, okay? So in the lack of stimulus, in the dark, guess what happens to those rod and cone cells? What do? Sodium channels are opening. What is that producing? Like an IPSP or an EPSP? What does a sodium channel do when it opens up? An EPSP, right? So in the dark, that's when the rod and cone cells are being stimulated because of these sodium channels that are open. It's producing EPSPs and rods and cones in the dark because of those sodium channels. So that, and when sodium enters a cell, that is what? Depolarization. That's just a classical definition of depolarization. You should understand how that happens. So that, we call that a dark current due to sodium entering the cell in the lack of stimulus. All right. Now, when stimulus is applied to the rods and cones, that's when those sodium channels close. When the sodium channel closes, what does that do to the membrane potential? Okay, that, yeah, inhibits the cells. That produces what? Hyperpolarization. In the way that we thought about neurons before, hyperpolarization is an IPSP. So in light, that produces IPSPs or hyperpolarizes the rod and cone cells, which is different compared to most receptor systems that we looked at. All right, so how does that happen? Why does it happen that way? It has to do with cyclic GMP and the interaction with this sodium channel. All right, so here we see a disc, and remember the outer segment of rod and cone cells have these stacks of discs, and in the discs you have rhodopsin. So here is the retinol. It should be bent so that it fits in the, and it says cis. The cis form is the bent form, so it fits in the opsin molecule. All right, but look what the neighbor is right here, some G-proteins. And G-proteins can be used to signal cascades, right, develop second messengers inside the cell. All right, so when in the dark, the sodium channel is open, so sodium is going from high concentration to low. The sodium channel is open because there is a cyclic GMP molecule, and cyclic GMP is very similar to cyclic AMP, right, which is a second messenger in some receptor systems. All right, so when sodium enters a cell, that depolarizes the cell, and that prevents, that actually stimulates the release of an inhibitory neurotransmitter on the synaptic ending of a rod and cone cell. I have another picture that will show you that in just a second. All right, so I might have to talk about these slides in succession a couple times in order for you to actually see what's going on here. All right, but when light hits a rod cell, light comes in and it causes what? A conformation change of retinol from a curved form to a straight form, right? That activates the G protein. The alpha subunit of the G protein then bumps into a phosphodiesterase. And phosphodiesterase is another class of enzymes that I haven't tested you on yet, but you've heard of kinases. What does a kinase do? It phosphorylates something. A phosphatase takes a phosphate off. And a phosphodiesterase will convert a cyclic AMP or a cyclic GMP into just a regular old straight chain AMP or GMP. It inactivates cyclic GMP. And when cyclic GMP is taken out of the outer segment of a cell, it has to unbind from the sodium channel. And when it unbinds from the sodium channel, it changes conformation, okay, and that prevents further depolarization, right? If you prevent further depolarization, what is that? That really is the opposite of depolarization is hyperpolarization, okay? So that's how light causes hyperpolarization of this cell. And when the cell is hyperpolarized, it's not going to release neurotransmitter. All right, so let's look at the next slide. So I think this is an exam figure, and this for sure is an exam figure. So let's look at two conditions. We have one condition that's in the dark, and the other condition when light is hitting a photoreceptor cell, and this is your last slide in the lecture right here. All right, so here you see the outer segment. And in the dark, what do we have? We have the, what we call a dark current. What's the dark current due to? It's due to these sodium ions that are moving through these sodium channels. What's it doing to the cell membrane right here? The potential. It's depolarizing it, right? When the cell is depolarized, it releases neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, this neurotransmitter, as you recall, neurotransmitters can be inhibitory or excitatory. This neurotransmitter is inhibitory on the bipolar cell. So the bipolar cell won't start any action potentials. It won't trigger any action potentials. No action potentials going to the brain means what? Lack of stimulus. So in the dark, even though the rod cell is depolarizing, It's not sending action potentials to the brain because this neurotransmitter is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. All right, now what's the reaction that happens when light is turned on? All right, when light is turned on, you get the bleaching reaction. You get the G protein activated. That activates that phosphodiesterase, which then converts cyclic GMP into regular old GMP, dissociates from the sodium channel, causing it to close. That hyperpolarizes a cell, and hyperpolarization is what? It's a way of inhibiting the cell. So when the cell is inhibited, it won't release neurotransmitter. And don't forget, that's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So now the bipolar cell becomes activated because it's not being inhibited by the neurotransmitter from this rod cell. So now the bipolar cell starts to release excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, which then triggers action potentials that go to the brain, which then you appreciate as light, because where is it going to the brain? Yeah, the occipital lobe. So the occipital lobe gives you the perception of light. All right, but that's a very complicated kind of sense. There's a lot of signal processing with those other kinds of neurons besides the bipolars. All right, so we don't get into that in this class. I think it would be really nice for you just to be aware of this system right here because it's so odd, right? Usually when you depolarize a cell, that causes a perception in your brain. But in the visual system, when the rod cells depolarize, that actually prevents action potentials from going to your brain because it's releasing a inhibitory neurotransmitter. That's why. Okay? All right, so that's it for the senses system, unless you guys got some questions. Ah, we're done a little bit early. Okay, any questions on vision? No? Okay, so that's it. I put a study guide online. I'll put some more online tonight. So over the weekend, you should have all the study guides for the next test coming up. Okay. Yeah. It's not ready to go, but I'll put it on really soon. Okay.